Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and tech that's accessible and entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. I'm here with Tim Henney, who's sitting in for John Wells today. Today in the program, we'll speak with Simon Head. He's a senior fellow at the Institute for Public Knowledge at NYU and senior member of St. Anthony's College at Oxford University. Now, he's concerned about what computer business systems are doing to trump human expertise. He'll join us to talk about the cases of companies like Walmart and Amazon and what the big questions are for humans to stay viable in this computer age.
Good morning, Lynn. There's a new aquarium in Salt Lake. It's now the ninth largest in the U.S., triple the size of the old one, and it opened March 25th. It's the Loveland Living Planet Aquarium. We'll speak with its founder, Brent Anderson. Just to give you an idea of the size of this new aquarium, the old shark tank was 15,000 gallons. The new one, 300,000 gallons.
Can't wait to go. Some happy sharks. Oh, yeah. Much happier. All that plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back.
350 Main Brasserie is pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves chef Carl Fiesinger's Low Country Cuisine nightly starting at 5:30. Also serving Sunday brunch from 9 to 1. The website is 350main.com with reservation, menu, and contact information.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with Tim Henney, who's sitting in for John Wells today. Our first guest, Simon Head, joins us from Oxford, where he spends half his time. The other half he spends at the Institute for Public Knowledge at NYU, where he's a senior fellow. He's concerned about the big questions of how computer systems are trumping human expertise and what it's doing to the middle class, among others. He argues that computer business systems, or CBSs in this case, cannot replace the human interaction, but are employed to do just that. And he explores what it's doing to our workforce in his new book, Mindless: Why Smarter Machines Are Making Dumber Humans. He explores specific examples of his argument, looking at companies like Walmart, Amazon, Goldman Sachs, and decides how they're implicated in the problem or the solution. Simon Head, thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you for joining us. And first, let's sort of set the stage for what computer business systems, or CBSs, are. You call them the semi-discovered black holes of the contemporary economy.
That's right. They are of enormous importance. They are relied upon by corporations, big and small, to order their affairs. But they're not well known. And there's a real contrast here between their predecessors, which were industrial systems of the machine age, such as the Ford system, which were quite well understood. People knew what was going on behind the factory walls. It's one of the reasons why you had the rise of trade unions, social democratic parties, even revolutionary parties. They knew what was going on. But we now have these systems, which I think are essentially industrial in the way that they work. And they're not well understood. And I think it's very important that they should be. It's important that the civic society should know about the systems which dominate us when we're in the workplace. We spend half our time, at least, in the workplace. We need to understand what's going on there while we're there. So that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book.
So it seems to maybe the layperson that you're talking about IT solutions that create better efficiencies in staffing or stocking or things like that. But what is it that we're missing? What are the components that we don't know about?
Well, I think one of the most fruitful ways to think about these systems is that they do have their origins in the machine age. If you think of the Ford system, it pulled together a lot of technologies to perform one very complex task, which was to make a car from beginning to an end. It pulled together the technologies of steel making, of the machine shop, the stamping plant, the assembly line, the paint shop, and the testing station, and out comes the Model T. And this mass production model became refined and more elaborate in the course of the 20th century. Then we have a situation where these methods are transformed or transferred to companies which are called service sector companies by economists, like Walmart and Amazon, but which really aren't, which are really like industrial companies because they compete by making their so-called processes of moving goods from the warehouse into the shelves very, very fast and very, very efficient. And they're rigorously controlling and timing the activities of employees to do it, and I think they're pushing employees beyond the limits, particularly at Amazon Corporation. So what I'm concerned about is when you take these methods and you start applying them in these situations when we're dealing with each other, as we are in so-called customer relations management, we are in healthcare, education, so-called human resource management, administration, all these areas where the transactions are between us, and yet I think these systems are being applied inappropriately to simplify and speed up these processes. So we have what I'm calling misindustrialization. It's being done in order to increase productivity and in order to decrease labor costs. You need fewer workers to do it, and they can be less skilled because you're relying on technology and so-called expert systems to perform many of the tasks humans used to do, but it just doesn't work very well. That's the problem.
So, I mean, you just answered a question I was going to ask about the application, and you called it a misapplication of these systems. And yeah. I'm wondering, you've said that they're extremely important today and that they've, you know, become important over time, but are they necessary? I mean, there's importance because we rely upon them and we're trying to squeeze out additional efficiencies. Mm. But if there's a misapplication, that questions the necessity of these systems.
Well, I think the crucial thing is how they're used. I think any organization needs to keep tabs on what it's doing. It needs to have targets, and it needs to know if they're being realized or not. The question is, how rigorous is this regime? I think there's a fallacy which runs through a lot of analysis of this subject, particularly by economists, because if you look at the early days of technology, you had a situation where technologies come along and certain skills become obsolete once the technologies arrive. One saw this going back to Adam Smith and the pin factory. Pin factories were made, pins were made on a sort of assembly line. And then when you come forward to the computer age, you have something like the mainframe computer, which took over a lot of tasks like payroll, the so-called back office tasks of businesses. So you have a very sort of determinist relationship between technologies and skills. The technologies come along, certain skills disappear. But when you look at these systems, which are much more complex, the relationship between technology and skills is also complex because there are different regimes which can govern their use. They can be more or less intrusive and more or less demanding of employees. And I think that in the 20-odd years that these systems have come into existence, because it's an era when labor has been extremely weak, you know, we've seen the drastic decline of labor unions and their influence both in the US and the UK, the terms on which these systems are used is very, very much biased in favor of management. And you see that with what goes on at Walmart. I mean, really, employees are being pushed to the limit.
So, Simon, do you think the employees at Walmart and the users of these systems, and since you just brought up Walmart, do you think the user being Walmart has the intention? Do they understand the consequence, the dehumanization of the system when they apply, the computer system to their process? Do they have an intention of dehumanizing it, or is that just the fallout and the unintended consequence?
I think their primary interest is in earnings and profitability. I think that the calculations which drive these systems in their most extreme forms, they're not setting out to dehumanize people. I mean, that's an evil motive, and I wouldn't ascribe it to them. But what they're doing in a situation of extreme competitiveness is to increase productivity as much as they possibly can, and they do that by speeding up work and monitoring it, and also by reducing costs. And one of the ways they do that, which I do think borders on the ruthless, if you look at both Walmart and Amazon, it's a very penal regime. Walmart stores are undermanned by intention, so the employees are often in a situation which, when really they have too much work to do and they don't meet their targets, and when they don't, they get a demerit. There's an elaborate system of demerits at Walmart, and if you get too many demerits, you're out, and even the most productive employees can get demerits. So there's a kind of aura where you're on the edge of being in trouble, and it's not a good situation for asking for a pay rise, and you do have this situation both at Walmart and Amazon, when you have very strong productivity and very low wages, and rather stagnant wages, particularly in relation to productivity. And I think that is something which is deliberate, and it yields high competitiveness and high profitability.
I have to wonder about the sustainability of that business model. How can you have this unintended consequence that keeps people in a cycle of demerit and not being able to keep up with the workload that's dictated by a computer system, taking the human element out, the social interaction, the fun, let's say. I mean, work needs to be fun for it to be sustainable over a long period of time. That's unsustainable. Is that not obvious to the users of these systems?
Well, that's an extremely good question. And I think you have to look at this in the context of the employment situation at the level of the labor market we're talking about. We're talking about a situation where unemployment is quite high, particularly among youth. You have categories of labor being pushed onto the market. For example, people coming off welfare, single mothers. I mean, their employment prospects aren't that great. And Amazon and Walmart are big employers. Mm-hmm. So the labor market at this level is pretty much biased towards management and not labor. And, of course, both Walmart and Amazon are ruthlessly anti-union companies, particularly Walmart. Walmart has a jet at its headquarters in Bentonville, and if it hears that there are rumors of unionization at a Walmart store, a union-busting team will descend from the heavens in their corporate jet, and they'll organize a very vigorous campaign to stop it. In Canada, in the province of Quebec, when a Walmart store actually voted for unionization, Walmart closed it down. So we're operating in a situation, as I say, when the local micro-labor market is very favorable to management, and when they keep it so by keeping out unions.
But management on the higher level, you would think, as Tim was talking about, this notion of sustainability, if there's this disposable labor force at the bottom end with others out there very willing and happy to come in and take the jobs that have been vacated, that cycle is still not sustainable. I would think not, unless, the notion is that unskilled workers are so easy to replace because they're just that, unskilled. You don't have to teach them skills.
Well, I think you've raised an extremely important question, which is as much an ethical question as an economic one. And one would expect a kind of political movement or political sentiment to arise out of this, that something must be done about it. And of course, we have a precedent for that in the New Deal. I mean, the conditions of the New Deal or the Great Depression on the eve of the New Deal were much more extreme than they are now. You had unemployment of 25% in the United States, and you had the rise of progressive unionism and the progressive wing of the Democratic Party under the leadership of President Roosevelt, and you had a whole lot of measures which did alleviate the situation. Mm-hmm. Now, you might think that since the Great Recession of 2007 and 8, we would have something comparable in the United States and indeed in the UK, where we had very severe economic conditions. It hasn't actually happened. The most noticeable political development has been the rise of the Tea Party, and that is certainly a movement of resentment, but it's a resentment of the right, not the left. It's directed against big government, and it's actually, to some extent, directed against big business. The Tea Party was not favorable to Mitt Romney, who it saw as a schmoozer, if you like, a big business. So the politics of this is not necessarily working out as one might expect if one looks at the politics of the New Deal era and the post-war period in the United States.
Now, back in the first industrial age, I think in general there had not been conversation surrounding the human element. You know, maybe it was before that time. Now we're very new agey, and we talk a lot about the human element. And while we may not have the power of unions that were developed back in that time, we do have the power of bad PR. And if you look at a company like Amazon, public relations is very important to them. And you look at the contradiction that you bring up in your book, these two words, care and trust. It's very much the human element. They try to engender that in their customers, but it's the opposite in their employees. Talk about that a little bit and why it just seems to me that it's not going to work over the long term.
Well, again, that's really a very good point. We've been talking about Walmart and Amazon a lot, but I think it's very important to understand that these systems, computer business systems, have an effect higher up the employment hierarchy than just at the very unskilled level at Walmart and Amazon. I mean, the issue at Walmart and Amazon is not between running the systems in a way which favors skill and ways that don't. It's more a question, really, of the dignity of employees. But if you get into areas like healthcare and education, then you really are talking about workplaces where real skills are in operation and where these systems have the effect of diminishing very significant skills. And I think we've seen this in healthcare. I think that the most brutal, if you like, HMOs have tried to use a kind of automated form of medicine to limit the treatment decisions of doctors. Now, of course, you do have a problem here that the U.S. healthcare system encourages physicians, in order to safeguard themselves against lawsuits, to order up all kinds of tests and treatments which may not be necessary. But on the core question of who is ultimately responsible for treating patients, particularly when they have significant illness, it has to be the physician. We've seen again and again that HMOs, in order, again, to cut costs and to reduce the liability to themselves, in paying out what they call medical loss, paying out to people who are insured through them, you see them using these algorithms and these treatment protocols to influence the decisions of physicians towards standard, cheaper treatments. And I think that's something which raises not just economic questions, but ethical questions as well.
Simon, are there examples that would contrast with the ones that we're talking about right now of companies that have been able to achieve gains in productivity but keep the human element out and have looked at using computer business systems and decided not to use them or have applied them in a way that maintains the human element?
Yes, I think there definitely are. Actually, the most interesting case history is there are two case histories I'd draw attention to. One is an extraordinary situation which existed at Xerox Corporation. There was a period of about 12 years from the late 1980s to the millennium when there was this extraordinary think tank attached to Xerox called Xerox PARC, Palo Alto Research Center, and they were a collection of really brilliant, inspired researchers in all kinds of disciplines, computer science, social anthropology, philosophy, and business studies. And they were working out ways to use some of the systems governing the working lives of Xerox machine repairmen, whether out in the field or in the call center, and to make the systems more supportive of human skill rather than replacing it. And the research which came out of Xerox PARC is of enormous value, but more important than that, in a kind of dialogue with Xerox management, they did actually significantly change the way the systems work, particularly in the work of the machine repairmen. You also have a whole school of system design in Scandinavia, which was influenced by Xerox PARC, and where you find alternative ways of using these systems operating on a much bigger scale relative to the size of the economy than you do in the United States or the UK. And that's something which needs to be looked at, I think, much more than it has been.
Leave it to Scandinavia to bring in the human element.
Right.
I mean, really, isn't it that in and of itself is the way that you view the importance of the human element as a society?
I think so. I think that's absolutely right. I think that you have to bring in the ethical dimension of this, that we're talking about people in their lives, whether they're economists who might win a Nobel Prize or whether they're people working on the shop floor at Amazon. It's their lives, and they have a right to dignity. They have mm-hmm. a right to be treated with respect, and they have a right to be fairly paid for what they do, and they have a right to make the most of what talents they have. And I think that the ethical dimension of these systems is that they are being used in ways that don't respect that dignity and that right of self-fulfillment. And that's why I'm suspicious of treating these subjects simply as pure economics. We have to emphasize the ethical moral dimension to this, I think.
So, Samit, how do you do that? Is it simply assigning a value to the ethical component, to the human component, and plugging that in so that you sort of transform the computer business system and you come up with an application that does value the human element? And is that possible?
I think you have to have a great debate on it. There's this remarkable book called Capital, echoing Karl Marx, by a French economist, Thomas Piketty. And he was the one who came up with the 1%. He did the research. He and another French economist called Emmanuel Saïd did the research on the distribution of income and wealth in the U.S. and in France. And they did it by case of the IRS and looking at the tax records. And it's they who came up with this fantastic bias in the distribution of income and wealth to really the people absolutely at the pinnacle, the top 1%, the top 0.1%, and the top 0.1%. And we need a great debate on this, and I think we're beginning to get it. I think this imbalance of power and imbalance of income and wealth is beginning to influence the debate. And when it does, we have to look at this side of things. We have to look at try and understand how these biases have arisen. And I think the role of technology in creating a kind of new industrial working class is an extremely important element of this and has to be given its due weight. And so there's an obligation of all of us, particularly those of us who are in the media and academic life, to, as you are doing and I've tried to do, to look at these questions with an open mind and to see how they relate to issues which go way beyond economics.
Right. You know, it's interesting. You implicate to a certain degree business schools like Harvard Business School and then MIT, a very strong engineering school, and their IT departments. But it seems like places like that, it can start. We have spoken a couple of times at on our programs to Adam Grant, who wrote the book Give and Take, and he's in the Wharton School of Business. And he would tell you that self-fulfillment does contribute to the bottom line. And so, you know, it's nice and heartening to see that, you know, maybe we go out to a fringe and we see that it really doesn't work, and we come back. I don't know. Do you have any hope for that sort of thing to happen?
Well, there's a very important body of research indeed by somebody who works at Bain, one of the major management consultancies in Boston, Frederick Reichheld. He's done research on what he calls the loyalty effect. And he's looking at call centers and call centers where agents on the 1-800 lines that are promoting companies' products or they're dealing with queries from clients. And he's actually quantified the beneficial effects of loyalty. In the first instance, the loyalty of employees. In situations where employees are treated well, where they're properly paid, and where the systems respect their dignity and skill, and there's a knock-on effect. And Reichheld shows this using rigorous statistical methods. There's a positive knock-on effect from the loyalty of the employees who stay in the job, for one thing. They stay in the job, they get to know the job, they get to know the products, and they get to know the clients. That's the important thing. And so there's a knock-on effect from the loyalty of employees to the loyalty of clients. And Reichheld shows that. So actually, it's in the interest of companies to begin biasing their systems more in favor of employees, more in favor of skill, more in favor of decent pay. And if the employees want to join a union, fine. So it's not just a question of ethics. It's also a question of enlightened self-interest. And one has to ask, you know, why relatively few companies are doing this? That's a very good question.
So, I mean, I just have to say as an observation, and I don't know if you're a fan of science fiction, but this is a theme that, you know, as an observation that's been prevalent in all sorts of science fiction stories for a long time now. I'm thinking off the top of my head, you know, the Terminator stories and Matrix. Yeah. It's always about machines rising to prominence and controlling and using humans as a commodity of some sort of resource. And we're nothing but a resource commodity to the machine, which is now the dominant intelligence and system in the universe. And, I, you know, it's nice to hear that you think that we're having this debate and it's time for the debate. And it's also a little frightening to think that there are paths and one of those paths leads to what we've seen in these science fiction visions.
Well, there's an extremely powerful trend in American business culture, which is called scientific management. And it goes back to Frederick Winslow Taylor, and it goes all the way back to the Fordist assembly line. And the fundamental principle of scientific management is that there are experts, let's call them scientific managers, who can plan how work ought to be done. They can work out the one best way for work and then make sure that the employees do it. Now, if you're dealing with the primitive assembly line, that more or less works, and it's what Ford and Taylor did. They worked out the simplest and fastest way to perform the jobs on the line, and that was the way things were to be done. Those were the rules. And you see it in Amazon Corporation, and you see it in some of the HMOs, the best way to treat patients. So it feeds in to using computers and expert systems to try and reproduce the principles of scientific management in much more complex situations. In financial services, if you look at the mortgage machine on Wall Street, the way it worked in the run-up to the crisis, even in higher education where I am, you see the influence of the scientific managers in the one best way and the subordination, not just of Amazon workers, but of academics, for example, to systems which embody the superior wisdom of experts. And that's something which has to be fought, I think, because the situations where we deal with each other, even with a call center, are actually too complex to be dealt with in this way.
Mm. Well, you bring up just a world of issues that really need to be explored further, which you do, of course, in your book, Mindless, Why Smarter Machines Are Making Dumber Humans. And Simon Head, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thanks. And that was Simon Head again, calling in from Oxford, and very interesting. And it kept going through my head, this phrase you often hear, but how will the stockholders receive that?
Yeah.
You know, and the stockholders need to be sold a different bill of goods, maybe one that encompasses an entire societal look at the human element fitting in with the machine.
Long-term sustainability. I think that's a critical issue, and that's one that he hits on with this whole thing. And, you know, the whole idea of making humans commodities and treating them that way. And it's almost, you know, I've heard it before. There is this thought that by taking advantage of that low-level workforce, the unemployed who are always, you know, siphoning off of unemployment and into the workforce and paying them just enough so that they can spend what they earn at your store. Mm-hmm. It's almost the company store model. You're exploiting that end of the workforce and they spend all your money in your company, and then you use a system like this to squeeze every ounce of profitability out without concern about the human element. And it's a vicious cycle.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there are other companies that, you know, do similar things and really do put a priority on people. And one of them that I've heard has that business model is Costco. And they're very successful.
Absolutely.
And the stockholders are very fond of Costco.
And lots of employee loyalty there as well. Yep. I spoke to someone who went to Davos, that economic summit they have every year in Switzerland. He went this year, and there's usually a theme. And I said, what was the theme this year? And he said, sustainability. And it's funny, at this municipal level, we talk about sustainability.
Right.
It's like solar panels
and
green roofs and stuff like that. And so I said, sustainability, huh? And he said it was more this sort of thing that Simon Head was speaking of. So very interesting. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back with the founder of the Loveland Living Planet Aquarium in Salt Lake. Just opened its doors about 3 weeks ago. Brent Anderson will be joining us. So stay tuned.
The Winter Sports School in Park City is proud to sponsor the Youth Winter Sports Report. We are currently accepting enrollment applications for 2014, our first year as a Utah State Charter School. For more information, wintersportsschool.org or 435-649-8760. The Winter Sports School is a nonprofit organization.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
We've all heard the awe-inspiring songs of the humpback whale. But Dr. Roger Payne heard it first. The renowned whale and ocean expert closes the Park City Institute Strategic News Service speaker series on Friday, April 18th. The evening, titled Oceans, Whales, and People, begins at 7:30. Tickets are $25. Call 655-3114. Brought to you by the not-for-profit Park City Institute, educating, illuminating, and entertaining since 1998.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, sitting in with Tim Henney, who is filling in for John Wells this week. Well, 17 years from concept to completion, what began as a small exhibit in the Gateway Center in Salt Lake, then moved to a larger location in Sandy, and now opened its doors about 3 weeks ago in Draper. It's the 9th largest aquarium in the country. It has a 4D theater I can't wait to hear about, a 40-foot observation tunnel to see the 300,000-gallon shark tank. And we've invited the founder, Brent Anderson, to join us and tell us about how he stuck to his dream and why you should be excited about visiting the new aquarium. Brent Anderson, founder of the Loveland Living Planet Aquarium, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. Good morning.
It's really nice to have you here. And first of all, I want to just start with your story. You became interested in the aquatic life when you were about 5 years old. Tell us about it.
And actually, growing up here in Sandy, I received a book for my birthday when I was 5 years old from my grandmother. It was a time-life book about the sea, and that book just captivated me. I looked at that almost every single day and was just entranced by everything that I saw. And so when I saw this picture of I asked my dad, what is a scuba diver? It was a scuba diver. What did he do? And he said, he's a marine biologist, so that's what I decided my course in life would be.
How many people have you run into who have had a course for their lives since the time they were 5 years old, essentially? I don't think I've ever met one.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's not as common. People usually move around from career choice to career choice, but I never found anything else as appealing as marine biology.
Yeah, which is probably what helped you stick to this dream of, and I feel like this must be your realization of the dream with this aquarium. I mean, it's not going to move. It's here for good.
Yes, it's finally here. I mean, after all this time and after envisioning how it would look and the size and everything that would be in it, and then now to have it a reality, sometimes it's a little surreal. Like, I almost think I'm walking through another city's aquarium instead of, Utah's aquarium.
I know, which is a very great thing for you to say, because when I think aquarium, you know, I've been to the one in Monterey and the one in Seattle, and I think of them as being on the ocean. And yet we're very landlocked here, as I'm sure you felt your whole life, except for when you studied marine biology at, UC Santa Barbara?
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah, so why here? I mean, you obviously have ties to Utah, but why did you stay here?
Well, probably one of the best places to build an aquarium is in a place that is so far away from the ocean, in particular, and many of the ecosystems that we show here at the aquarium. And that's really the genesis of why build one here, and especially what is going to be inside of it. That was focused on ecosystems from around the world, marine, rainforest, freshwater, showcase the animals that live there and let people understand how they work, but then tie that back together so that people come away with the understanding that it's really just one global living planet. And when we can do that, impart that knowledge to everybody, I think it'll have a positive impact.
So, Brent, you know, you and I share that whole marine biology fascination from a young age. The first thing I wanted to be was a marine biologist, but I didn't stick to it. So you did. Congratulations on that. And you obviously have a deep-seated driving passion. So now, having opened this aquarium on the 25th of March, can you look back, through the process of your life and I guess specifically to the process that you've been through with the aquarium that Lynn outlined, from first a little exhibit at the gateway to the location in Sandy or wherever it was to the new facility. And can you say, wow, I can't believe I made it? Or do you say, that was a no-brainer? This was something looking back that just had to be, and you found a way to make it happen. What was that like?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I can't believe it finally got done after all this time. But at the same time, I had this clear vision of what it would be like and just kind of visualized it as though it already existed. And that, I guess, that's part of the process of sticking with it, is being able to see it complete to get me through those hard times in order to actually, make sure that it happened.
Well, and tell us about the structure of the aquarium. Is it a nonprofit? Is it a for-profit? Is it funded by, where does the funding come from, and what's the structure?
Well, it's a nonprofit organization, a 501c3, and we funded it through a combination of, as we built up the first aquarium in Gateway, and then the second one, we were essentially building up assets, whether it's animals, fish, or tanks, and also building our team. And so we've really been doing it slowly for a long time. And then we got a big infusion from some very generous donors, the Loveland Foundation, as well as many other donors, state and county and the city, everybody coming together. This essentially, it's the community's own this. It's not any person's. So really, it belongs to everybody in the state. And through all those efforts and volunteers and just hundreds and hundreds of people, we all walk side by side and managed to get this built.
So, Brent, going back to what we have in common and you know, that whole marine biology aspect of our interest from a very early age, I've spent, you know, I'm not really a zoo or aquarium person, but I have had probably some of my most memorable, you know, wildlife experiences in aquariums. I absolutely love aquariums. And at the same time, I understand the dark side of aquariums, the things that we're seeing in the news these days about the orcas at SeaWorld, that sort of issue, the treatment of animals. What's your position on that with your aquarium?
Well, we made a decision right when we started that we weren't going to house any of the marine mammals like dolphins or killer whales or any of that. And that's just a matter of what amount of space is needed for a particular animal. And when we look at that, any display, we have to take that into account before we ever go down the road of selecting, you know, an animal for that. And as well, that whatever animal is in there has to be one that does well in a recreated environment.
Okay, so that makes me think about this huge shark tank, which is undoubtedly one of the features of the aquarium. It's 300,000 gallons. And one of the great things is this 40-foot tunnel that goes through it, so you can really see what's going on. So talk about maybe the habits of a shark and what their range is and then how they're accommodated in the shark tank.
Well, the shark tank size is determined by what type of sharks you want to put in there.
Mm.
So if the full-grown shark is, say, 7 feet, then you want to have a glide path ratio of at least 7 to 1, which would mean a 49 to 56-foot long tank. And so our tank is 80 feet, so we have plenty of room for the specific species that we selected. And as well, we know those animals do extremely well. For instance, all of our sandbar sharks were born in captivity at Shark Week in Las Vegas. And so, you know, they tend to do very well in this type of environment. The size of the tank gives them plenty of room. And then, of course, the water quality parameters are closely monitored as well.
Okay. Huh. Can't wait to see it.
I still have to ask, though, is there an ethical issue about putting animals in captivity, even if, you know, we've come up with these equations that determine the size of the tank that's required and how well they do? Do you still wrestle or struggle with, or do you feel that's been completely addressed? Because you are taking creatures and putting them in a confined area,
sure.
And these are wild animals. You know, wild is part of what we call them, their definition. And I'm just bringing it up. I love aquariums, as I said, but there is kind of this overhanging question.
Well, I think that's, you know, for some animals, that's just something, like I said, the ones that have the higher levels of intelligence are the ones that are probably the ones you need to be very careful about. What type of environment are you creating for them? And most importantly, what size of habitat would they actually need in captivity? So, for instance, a Pacific giant octopus, which is actually a fairly smart animal, maybe as smart as a house cat, they really don't like to go out in the open because that's in their nature. That's risky for them. They get preyed upon. And so they like to be in a small little environment. So it really depends on each individual animal. And we've made sure that all of our tanks are sized appropriately. And there's also enrichment that we do for the animals, where we regularly engage the animal in puzzles or games or play, you might say. But really, it's just an activity that keeps them stimulated and interested.
Right. And the flip side of this question is the fact that you're bringing awareness to, you know, as I said before, landlocked people, you know, a huge population here of, you know, a lot of people who may never see the ocean or see these marine creatures. So talk about that, just the exposure and the education that you're giving.
I think that's really the reason that has the thing that has the most impact on somebody deciding to make a different decision about how they might treat the environment or purchase products, et cetera, is do they have any connection to that, either ecosystem or to that animal in particular? And if they've never seen it, they've only seen it in a book or on TV, it's a much different bond that occurs there versus one when you actually see that animal face-to-face and you get to understand it and become more fascinated by it. If that takes place, especially at a young age, you're more likely to make those decisions throughout life that would lead to something. Maybe you won't eat fish, or you might not choose to do something that might harm the environment. You might go out and actually do the opposite and go out to conserve and try to do everything that you can to preserve these environments. So we're trying to teach people as much as we can about the information, give them that knowledge so that we can have informed citizens who make great decisions based on that information.
That's nice. And part of that education is, of course, this new 4D theater. So I'm wondering if as I'm sitting in there, am I going to have, like, is it going to feel like an octopus has wrapped themselves around my arm or something?
In some cases, yes. If cool. Anybody's ever been to a Disney park and seen the, for instance, Bug's Life Theater or the others, where if there's a coconut on the screen, it smells like coconut in the theater. Or if a dolphin splashes on the screen, you feel a spray of mist on your face. So that's that fourth dimension, which is on top of the 3D glasses and 3D film.
Oh, that's neat. And I've never actually been to one of those theaters. I must be pretty deprived. But there aren't very many of those in the country, right?
Well, there's a handful. They're starting to become a little more popular. This is the first one in Utah. So we're excited to be able to bring this to Utah for the first time.
Brent, what other exhibits are the must-see? I mean, there must be some highlights. And I know from my experience with aquariums, the two mind-blowing experiences that I had, and I don't know if they were at the Monterey Aquarium or the Seattle Aquarium, is probably one at each, but one was the tuna tank, which I just could not believe the size of the tank and the size of the fish circulating through. And I just stood there for, it had to be an hour, and watched those giant tuna circle around this tank, which was phenomenal. The other one, which was much to my surprise, was the jellyfish exhibit with these orange jellyfish circulating through a tank. And again, I was mesmerized. Is there something that you'd like to highlight at your aquarium that's going to have that effect on your visitors?
Well, I think the one that for me personally has been the most surprising, I guess, because even though I was involved in designing and we were working on concepts for this Amazon rainforest, when I finally actually set foot in there with all the live plants and the trees and the waterfall, everything going on in there, and it's 60% humidity and it's 80 degrees, that's when I really got that sense that, wow, this is an impressive rainforest right here in Utah. So that one was pretty, for me, that was a really great experience to visit that one. I think our visitors have done the same. And I'm a marine biologist at heart, though, so the Shark Tank has captured my imagination again.
Well, we've talked about the animals and their enclosures. What about the overall facility and the people who are going to circulate through? How many people can you handle, and do you have sort of like a per-hour number that can come in? Are you going to, you know, cap the amount of people that can come, or is it first come, first serve, wait in line, and take your chances?
Well, the first few weeks, there have been a few days where we've had to actually stop the number coming in because we hit our capacity of 2,500 people. And that's nothing new for a facility that's just open. So we can typically process about 1,200 people an hour. And like I said, we've hit that a few times. We can also host events at nighttime. So we've had several people rent the facility, and they'll have an event for 2,000 people or 1,000 people come in. And so both daytime as well as nighttime activities, our total visitation just so far has been about 130,000 people.
Wow.
And is that meeting your expectations or surpassing? Where are you on your business plan?
Well, that's right now we're running at about 2.5 times what our business plan was telling us. And we do that very conservative. So we put our best case scenario out there, and we're actually slightly above our best case scenario.
Well, that's nice to hear. And how many people? How long does it take for a person to go in the door and come out the exit? What's the usual visitation?
Everyone's different. Some people have spent 3 or 4 hours in here. Some people have spent an hour, hour and a half. So it just depends on how quickly you want to go, how much time you have to really see all the exhibits.
And what are your hours you're open to the public?
We're open from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. every day. The only 2 days we close are Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Okay. And I read, Brent, that during these first weeks, you have a kind of a special going. It's if you come, you get another free day later. Is that still going on?
Yeah, we decided, you know, in order to give everybody a chance to come back again, and that's part of the soft opening. So it's a 2-day ticket when you come, and through the end of this month. When you come, you get to use that ticket again anytime before the end of the summer.
Okay, that's great. Now, also, you're just over the county line in Utah County, but you're located in Draper on Lone Peak Parkway, is it?
Yes, it's at 120th South and Lone Peak Parkway.
Okay.
And that was an important decision for us as we looked, you know, at the valley to be placed in the center of what will become the center of the population. And so it's been a great decision we found out so far.
Yeah, interesting. So just south of the IKEA for those Park City people who who don't know the valley.
North of IKEA.
Oh, north of IKEA. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay, see, I don't know my South Salt Lake or my North Utah County.
And on the same side of 15 is IKEA?
Yeah, it's okay. On the west side. And there's two exits. You can get there from either 114 South or 123 South.
Well, that's going to make my next visit to IKEA about 6 hours.
Yeah, that'll make a full day out of it.
Yeah, it gives a better reason to go down there. Very good. Well, Brent Anderson, thank you so much for taking your time. I'm sure you're busy these days, and we really appreciate you speaking with us today.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
And best of luck. And again, that was the founder of the Loveland Living Planet Aquarium. Just opened its doors about 3 weeks ago. Well, coming up on a month. In Draper, and it sounds like my next trip to Salt Lake is going to be there. We'll be right back. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report every weekday at 6:50 and 7:50 during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher. Sponsored in part by Cushman & Wakefield Commerce Commercial Real Estate and Park City Mountain Resort.
Thanks for listening to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my fill-in co-host, Tim Henney. Thank you, Tim, for being here today.
My pleasure. And we'd like to thank our guest, Simon Head. He wrote the book Mindless, Why Smarter Machines Are Making Dumber Humans, an exploration of computer business systems and their application or possible misapplication. Also, Brent Anderson. He's the CEO and founder of the Loveland Living Planet Aquarium.
And also our underwriters, San Francisco Design, Prudential Utah Real Estate, Peak Art and Frame, and our producer, Beth Fratkin. Tune in tomorrow to Fun Friday. They'll speak with about the Tulip Festival at Thanksgiving Point, and they'll talk to the Natural History Museum about chocolate. Yum.